Welcome inside the coach's room. Every week, we talk to elite coaches and backroom staff about their experiences, how they develop, and how they develop their players.
There are now 10 teams in the Premier League who have a greater chance of achieving a goal or a shot on target through a set piece than a substitute. Team set pieces have now sort of overtaken substitutes as a way of threat and a way of getting back into the game. And you're sat as a gaff, got more chance of getting back into the game via a set piece than I have via a substitute.
In this episode, we talk to Sammy Lander. Sammy Lander is an English coach that specialized in substitutions, or as he would say, in finishers. We discussed the impact of substitutions, how you should communicate with players that are not playing in the first 11, and the proof in data that substitutions or substitutes are not impacting the game as they should. Enjoy this episode with Sammy Lander. Sammy, let's rock and roll. We're ready. How are you, man?
Excited to chat some football.
Perfect. Thomas gave an assist. Let's call it like that. Yeah, we should talk to Sammy because he's the first substitution or the first expert on substitutions, he said. The first that I know of. So it's really great to have you. And I think it's really interesting to have somebody that is focusing on such, let's say, it's not a small part, but a specific part of football, which is substitutions. I'm really excited to hear all the details. And after this podcast, everybody's going to be the best substitution coach ever, so you will be out of a job. No, but let's see where we have this discussion at. I saw a video. Yeah, maybe in the end, I want to be the gaffer, which I think is a funny word, by the way, if you're not English. but first, now I want to focus on substitutions. How? Why? How?
Yeah. So it was a crazy, crazy story, really. To be fair, when I was a first team coach, I was only sort of 21, 22, first team coach at Weymouth. And we'd had sort of reasonable success. We'd gone through the leagues.
What kind of level is it? Just to give some context.
So it was Southern Prem, National South, and then National League.
Okay. So it's like fifth, sixth tier of UK?
The league, yeah. That was exactly, yeah. So we had reasonable success. We'd done quite well. And perhaps the on the pitch had moved a little bit quicker than where the club was moving off of the pitch. So in the National League, most teams are of a full-time outfit. And unfortunately, we were still part-time, you know, paying players, you know, part-time wages. So it was a slightly different season for us because, you know, teams were coming in with like three or four kit men. And you know, at one stage, I was the kit man. Do you know what I mean? We all had to muck in and be the kit man because we didn't have one. So it was a really different season. And it was during COVID as well, which made things a little bit harder financially. A lot of resources were pulled because, you know, it was a really tough time. And some of those financial restraints meant that we couldn't pay players. So we got to a stage where I was actually being named as a substitute. And for me, it was a dream come true. Do you know what I mean?
So Sammy, I'm really desperate. I need you on the bench. Is that literally what happened?
Well, yeah, that's how I tell myself how it went. It was more, who can we get on the bench? It's going to have to be Sammy. But it was just a case of like, we would have to go to these teams. And if it wasn't, you know, for me being on the bench, we might not name a full bench. And, you know, that looks quite embarrassing.
Yeah, sure. I can imagine. You don't want to overcome week before before even starting the game.
Exactly that. So, yeah, I went on the bench and you can see in the background there, that's my shirt. I've got, you know, cool. I've got my shirt made up. I had my shorts, my shinies. I actually had to buy a new pair of boots because, you know, just in case that moment come where I had to bang a couple of hat tricks in, I had to make sure I was ready for it. You know what I mean? Might have been the start of my footballing career. So I was on the bench and I was experiencing it. And we're in one particular game and the striker's gone down and it's about the 86th minute. And the gaffer turns to me and he says, are you ready to go on? And I just thought, you know, Christ, nowhere near ready. Do you know what I mean?
I wasn't even ready to play before we went. We came here before.
I've been sat in this dugout. I've got a great bench coat on. I've been chewing at the jelly beans. Don't get me wrong. I'm watching the game because I'm still trying to do my coaching role and looking at our pressing shape and that sort of thing. But in terms of touching the ball, I'm feeling physically ready. Like, I'm nowhere near. And then I say thankfully, but I wouldn't have minded if I got on. The striker jumped back up and he finished the game, so I never got on. But it was that sort of like, that was the light bulb moment for me where I thought, wow, like, if I feel like this, there must be a lot of other players who are experiencing this sort of feeling as to being a substitute. And I wondered what I can do with it. And it started off really small, just going a little bit of how can I help a little bit. And it snowballed into this whole concept where there's now data and metrics and loads more things you can do with it than I probably thought at the time it could have gone.
Okay, cool. So yeah. It was putting in the position because I don't know. Do you still play, or let's say in your spare time, or you don't play at all?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I've always played. Do you know what I mean? And I've tried. I always try and play. I don't think I ever would have made it as a player. You know, I seem to have the brain for it, but it didn't ever correspond to what my feet wanted to do. So it was always a bit of a disadvantage. But I can play. But would I ever have turned professional?
Oh, okay. You know? So it wasn't, it was like you were, let's say, that's my assumption again. You were on the bench just to be a name on paper, to come across less weak. That's maybe exaggerating here, but but I can imagine, and that's also maybe something that you found there, that some players find themselves, even though they're part of the team, still in that position as well. Yeah, maybe second or third choice. Only if something happens, I have to be ready. Which you felt, let's say, real time there. But that's only the process of players themselves. So around the game. Then I started looking into it, and then there's also a lot of consequences of substitutes or players being ready or not being ready. Oh, I'm going fast already. But what were your next steps there? So, okay, you found yourself, okay, the gaffer again, which I still think is a funny word again. No, I'm not ready. But after the match, you go home, you sit, you think by yourself, okay, this needs to change. What happens then with you?
So it was a case of going, right, well, this is how I felt. And I wrote down how I felt in terms of physically wasn't ready, technically wasn't ready. You could argue psychologically not ready. And then from that, it was a case of, right, how can I build upon these sort of pillars to not only address these issues, but create metrics and create data and create analysis that then analyzes whether those pillars are being addressed. Because, you know, some data isn't always reflective. So you're going to need data that's going to show whether these pillars have actually changed or whether players are just set. You know, it comes in qualitative and quantitative types of data. There's not just one. And I always say that data has to come with context anyways. It can't just be one bit of data on its own. So then again, then you're building off that data to try and find background. So it was just a case of going pillar by pillar and going, right, how can I go into this, fully explore it, address to make sure that, you know, that players are actually going to get better with what we're going to implement, and then how can we actually track to make sure that the productivity is increased.
Yeah, so where did you start? So the let's say it was Sunday or Monday, what, Saturday or Sunday, the Monday you come in at the club, coach, we need, and I have some ideas about this. Where did you start?
So, well, interestingly, we were part-time, so I went home on the Saturday, and then I wasn't again till Tuesday evening.
Sure,
not the problems, but the challenges of being part-time.
Yeah, we've all been there. Yeah.
Monday. So I used that time to go home. And because it was during COVID, there wasn't else a lot on, you know, so I wasn't like there was anything much you could do with your life at that stage. It was a case of going to work, coming back and, you know, being in your bubble. So I literally just got about researching it and looking at all these sort of different teams, particularly in our league at the time, which was National League. Looking at whether their substitutes were making an impact. If they were there any patterns that I could see? Were there any behaviours? Was it just typically the teams with the bigger budgets had the best subs, which I still don't think is true. I think they have an advantage, but I don't think it's just like a given. So yeah, I went about all this stuff, and then I went in Tuesday and sort of pitched the role to Weymouth and just said, look, I want to implement a couple of things that I think might be able to sort of help our subs or finishers, as we called them. That was the first time we sort of transitioned into that word, into a game of football. And you know, we might reap the benefits of it because we might have players that are coming on feeling a little bit more engaged with the game.
Yeah. So that's the first, interesting thing, because you switched the name subs into, let's say, the concept finishers, which reminds me of baseball. We have like a closing, what's the name again? The closing pitcher.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. If you talk like that, you're not like a starter. No, I'm the closer. I get to bring the game home.
Mm.
Which kind of reminded me when you were talking about finishers, so people that finish the game, that take it home, or that change it or whatever. Mm. So that's,
yes,
that's something, probably the idea behind it, right?
Yeah, 100%. I was just going to add that, like, that's a great example of where we started with finisher, and it come from reading, you know, Eddie Jones's book and a little bit about how he sort of acts with his players and the culture that he creates. And that's where I got that idea. By the time I'd left Wimbledon, which is now 2 years later, you know, we had Energizer, we had Finisher, we had Closer, we had Game Changer, we had Match Winner. You know, we had all these names, and that's a great example of how the concept sort of develops with a little bit of experience and a little bit of actually trialing and error and finding out things. And we found that by giving more names, you give a player an idea of what you want from them as a substitute. So for us, an energizer would be someone who enters the game of football and really brings us a new lease of energy, really uplifts us. Typically, central midfielders will be energizers, potentially wingers, because we're pressing side as well. So that new energy came in. If we were 2-0 up, they would be a closer, and they would be, you know, the people that come on and just saw the game out for us, ensured that, you know, we left the stadium with 3 points. So that's a good example of where we started with something and the concept snowballed into something a little bit more in depth and a little bit more layered.
What did you see with the players when you didn't start calling them subs, but you call them, or the head coach called them finishers? And then we need energy, so you will be the energizer in the 75th minute or something. What does it do with players?
It's a great question, and I would say that what we experienced at more non-league level was that they enjoyed it, because they felt a little bit more value and empowerment than probably what they'd felt before. When I went into Wimbledon, and now a few of the clubs that I've worked with after, the younger players enjoy it a lot more than the older players. A great example would be that a 29-year-old centre-back, you know, who usually would get name on a bench, you usually have a centre-back or a defender on the bench. They don't need to be called a finisher in order to get over the sort of,
sure,
acceptance of being a substitute. They don't need to be called that.
They know their role. They've been experienced it before.
Exactly.
They know their position in the rankings within the team.
Yeah, exactly that. They knew what their role was going to be. They'd probably done it 10, 15 times already that season, so they might have already just had that acceptance for it. Young players who typically in academies, you know, play most minutes, because that's the way that academies are produced at the moment, where you have to play a certain amount of minutes. That transition from them going to that 18s, 23s, again, where you're still prioritised playing and development, to then into first team, that's sort of a real sort of career hurdle that you have to manage. Do you know what I mean? Where your role on a match day is very different to what it is when you were with the 23s or the 18s, because typically your younger players would be on the bench. So what we found is that they actually enjoyed that word, that it kept them engaged, it kept them feeling positive, and the word empower is what I will keep coming back to, because I think that's what you have to do to players to make them feel like they're going to go and win the game for you. They've got to feel empowered to do that.
Yeah. Would they already know that they would be a potential energizer or potential finisher, or before, let's say, the game starts?
That is probably dependent on the head coach or the manager or the gaffer. because, you know, every person will do it in their own way. I've been into some clubs who will name the lineup 2-3 days before, you know, providing that there's no injuries, and that's made clear to the players. But providing there's no injuries, they'd name it a couple of days before. I've been to some clubs who will name it on the Friday training, and I've been to one club that will name it on the Saturday. So there's a real sort of variety in the way that you can name that. So I think it depends a little bit on the manager and the culture that's being created in that club. Yeah. and the head coach already has.
What I did, it was because it actually got me thinking on my own process there, is that we had the last semi, let's say, is comparable level that you were talking about, that we had the last training session before the match was on a Thursday evening, then right after the training session, I would make the lineup for Sunday. Mm. Before I present the lineup to the starting 11, to the players, I would talk to all players that were, let's say, a discussion, so they would know whether why they would be starting or why they wouldn't be starting, because let's say 8 out of 10 know why they're playing, or they are, let's say, your regulars, and 3 out of 6 substitutes know why they are substitute, and there's, let's say, this group in the middle that is always like, am I in or out? So I would talk to these players straight after training, and then present the team, and then all the players would have 24 hours, that would be, let's say, my ruling or rule, to talk to me about whether they would agree or not, or show their emotions or whatever. Mm. Or they could call me or talk to me or agree or disagree. And then on Sunday, I didn't want to be bothered with any emotion anymore on the decision that was made Thursday, and the focus would be on the game. And yes, if you were a substitute and you decide, okay, I know I'm going to be a substitute, so I'll go out with my friends a little bit later than normal because I'm all beyond. That's your choice.
Yeah.
And you know you would be starting, because there's also a lot of coaches that would name, let's say, the starting 11 maybe 2 hours before the game, so everybody would supposedly be fresh, or in their mind, or would I don't know the English word. They would take into account their behavior on Saturday, for example.
Yeah. They'd have to treat it on a Friday like they were going to play on a Saturday.
Sure. And then, but the only thing that I didn't like then is if you disappoint the player then, 2 hours before the game, the emotion of the negative emotion is still connected to that moment, or is still there. And then you want him to come in and he's like, yeah, fuck off, you just disappointed me. I'm not saying that that's normal behavior, but that could happen. What is your idea on that process? Because that's also really connected to involving substitutes or communicating with them.
Mm. Yeah. So again, when I was at Weymouth and we were in the non-league, you know, obviously we only trained Thursday, and then the next time you would see the players would be Saturday.
Yeah.
So you would get in a habit of naming Saturday, because you would need players to act the right way in Friday, not because them, just because, you know, that they're going to have ownership, obviously, that they want to be ready themselves. But like you said, sometimes you can get players who sometimes make, you know, incorrect decisions, and by not naming the team till Saturday, it means that you sort of lower the chance of that. So I can very much see why managers do it. I've seen it happen, and what you hit the nail on the head. What we experienced was that you then almost sort of, I don't know what the right word is, you sort of slowly, gradually build their motivation, because they then think that they're going to play, and it's slowly going up. It goes all the way up Friday because they then think they're playing, and then it gets to Saturday where it's keep going up, and then you let them know they're a substitute or a finisher. Then it's like a sudden drop, and that's the emotion where I've had it before, where my role comes into its own, because then it's my role to ensure that those emotions are got rid of, or not got rid of, that those emotions are heard. And listened, because I would be the same. Do you know what I mean? It's not a nice process to go through, but it's important that you hear them, you know, help talk to them, maybe have a laugh with them. And that's where you as a coach have to be good with people, because some players will want to be listened to and really talk about it. Some players will want to be almost left and they'll process it in their own time. Some players like talking about other identities, like with their family or their girlfriend, and reminded that there's other things outside of football that they can value. And all these different sort of processes is done in, you know, a little 10, 15 minutes before they go out. And then it's, you know, good release. Now we're focused on the game. And touching on that, something that I think what I try and get across to managers and teams and that I speak to is that the role of a substitute isn't always just going on and scoring the winning goal. The role of a substitute might be that they have to warm up the striker who's going to go on and score the winning goal. And his involvement or her involvement is just as important as the player that goes on and scores the goal.
Yeah.
And I think the best example I can give is goalkeepers. I mean, I think the average team substitutes their goalkeeper maybe once a season. And it's the average of 36 minutes. That's what a second choice goalie gets a season, you know, in the league, cup competitions. Sometimes there's a rotation, but they will still strap their hands up. They'll still do a warm up. They'll still make sure that their first team goalie's warmed up. And I think that their attitude towards being a finisher or a substitute is tremendous. And it's because there's a real, you know, GK union there that they love each other and they want to support each other. And I think outfielders could sometimes mirror or image that a little bit, where your role might be on a Friday when you're doing pressing shapes and you're not in maybe the starting 11, but you might have to play like the opposition to really prepare the starting 11 to make sure that when they go on Saturday, they know what they're going to face, they know how they're going to play, and that's you contributing towards that result. And I think sometimes players don't see it like that. I think they see, unless they have a direct involvement in minutes, that they haven't contributed towards the win. But my role was sort of going in and showing that you can add value in lots of different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very hard process for players to switch, because the natural reward is I'm only important and I'm only happy when I'm in the starting 11, especially first teams and especially seniors. I think you was almost the same. So the attitude around it is the hard thing to manage. I think personally, and if I hear with you, that takes a lot of attention, because we've all experienced that if you're in the dressing room and you're preparing for a game and that one substitute is being or expressing a negative attitude in his body language, it's going to affect the whole dressing room, because everybody sees it and everybody is waiting or looking at the coach to act on it, either correct him or help him or whatever. It takes a lot of energy and time in that process. So I think it's very good that you say, okay, you have to know also the way that you have to deal with each person. Sometimes you just have to leave alone. They're going to be angry at you anyway. It doesn't, and maybe I've had that myself. It was a pretty cool player actually that wasn't benched a lot, but if he was benched, he was mad. He was seriously mad. And I knew if I put him on, he was going to use that energy to show me that I was wrong, so he would perform very well. But still, the reason behind it was not that he wanted to perform right. He wanted to prove me wrong, right?
Yeah. So
that's something as a coach you really need to manage. I even remember that he scored a winning goal and he flipped me the finger, let's say, in 50 yards in front of a full stand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew before I put him on the game, this was going to happen.
Yeah.
So afterwards in the game, I put him, let's say, in the middle of a dressing room. I said, I'm not even mad at you. I knew I'm happy with your reaction, but I'm not happy with your celebration. So if you ever do it again, you have a very big problem. And if somebody else does it, he also has a problem.
Yeah.
But for this time, I'm going to leave it. And I
think... Yeah, actually, that you say that, because this is something I've toyed with, is because sometimes you can motivate a player through the fear of proving people wrong. And I think that's a really big motivator. That's something I use daily. Do you know what I mean? When I need motivating, I think, who's doubted me? Right, that's my motivation. I'm going to keep going to prove them wrong. But I think when I talk, I don't know, if I would relate it to clubs I've been with and I'm in the environment, sometimes I think that can be a little bit dangerous.
Sure, I agree.
Yeah, because maybe you're going, now that player's only going to motivate himself through almost what we call a fuck you attitude, rather than the we not me and I'm going to do it for the team. They're now doing it for themselves. And again, it's something that the substitution concept takes on, is are they then going on and trying to force things because they feel like they need to go and win the game to prove that they should have started? Or are they going to go on, fit into the pressing shape, fit into the style of the game and be the player that the game needs? And it's interesting you say that. It's only then that I've sort of been reminded of it. But yeah, it's like, and like you say, it's so fine, you know, because we are people, and for me, people are the most fascinating thing in the world, because you don't know how they're going to react, and they're so random, and there's so many parts of a person that we're yet to properly understand, and all of that contributes to trying to deal with this natural career sort of hurdle. And it's really interesting to hear that.
Yeah, it's a hard process, because it also went wrong with him one time, that he came on and blah blah blah. It wasn't the right way, and he knew, but still, it worked out one time, and it didn't work out the other time, and then it doesn't work at all. So, but I think every coach, because I've talked to elite coaches through a year, and every coach says the hardest part of our job is disappointing people. And this is exactly that you have to manage, let's say, within your substitution role, because for us as coaches, as head coaches, let's make a category between you and me, but the head coach takes a decision, and it's a very, very hard decision, because you know you're gonna make somebody sad or angry or whatever, and you know already before you do it, because you know your players. And then to find a way to deal with it, it is also hard, but that's very important. Yeah.
Yeah. I've actually recently been doing my coaching badges. So I've had to...
I'm not saying you cannot be a head coach. No, I'm just...
I do it with a team, and, you know, I'm experienced what it's like to be a gaffer, you know, and I'm, you know, I love these lads. You know, the lads that I work with, they're incredible. They're all great lads. You know, I would consider them friends. But like you said, on a certain day, I've got to try and, as a friend, give them some really, you know, rubbish news, that a thing that every single player wants, which is minutes and playing, you're the one that's going to take that away from them. So it's really tough to build. And I think it is something that I actually value as a skill. You know, I'll be modest with it, but it's something that I've worked on and trying to develop, that I think the nature of a lot of my relationships was that I could be their friend, and I could be someone that they can talk to about their personal life. But then at the same time, there was that element of professionalism where you are going to have to be a little bit honest with them and, you know, address some of the issues that come naturally with being in, you know, in football, in terms of dropping a player or substituting a player or playing a player out of position or something like that. And yeah, I think it's like a skill that I will continue to develop, because I'm not saying it's perfect, but I think it's a skill that's really, really valuable in football in today's world.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, back to your job, because your expertise. So this is, let's say, more of a mental process around the game and before the game, where you really need to manage, let's say, the feelings or the emotions of the players. It has nothing to do with being game ready. It's maybe more the time between the decision you're on the bench and starting the game. But then there are, if I'm correct, but correct me if I'm wrong, there are multiple aspects to substitution, which is one, which I find highly interesting, is preparing the players to be ready. So the gaffer turns around, are you ready? Okay, what should you do leading up to that moment to have players properly ready? And then the other part is, okay, what is maybe the statistical influence of substitutes, and what, let's say, the process of getting players ready, what does it do with statistics? So let's start with the process first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I've got to be a little bit careful with what I reveal.
No, you don't have to reveal, because they can call you and then they can hire you. That's more important. Yeah. So that's what we're doing. We're promoting you.
So I'll use the example that you gave a second ago, where you've had the player who's, you know, given you a little bit of jip after scoring, and you said rightfully there, one time he's come on and scored the winning goal, and the other time he came on and it didn't work out so much. And the biggest thing that I can sort of address there is that substitutions for me aren't consistent. That you can't rely on a substitute, in my opinion, or very few substitutes will be consistent every single time they're a substitute. You know, it's almost a bit of a lottery where you go, I'm going to sub with a little bit of hope here and just hope that this guy comes on and produces something that we need right now, because, you know, he hasn't done the last three, but he might do today, or he might have done five games ago, but I need him to do it now. And for me, the consistency part of being a substitute is massive, and it's something that we really prided ourselves on, particularly at Wimbledon, because we needed that consistency. And the reason that I think that happens is because the substitutes don't take the same process to warm up every single game. So if you'd have looked at the time where your striker had come on and scored a goal and looked at what he'd done in the lead up to that, I personally don't believe that he would have done that routine every single time he's a substitute, because naturally sometimes when games are a little bit more tense, you find yourself drawn into them. So then you miss a warm up. You might be, I don't know, chatting to your mate who's on the opposition team. So then all of a sudden you're not warming up physically as well as you're meant to. It might be a really, really cold day. So you're going to wrap up a little bit more warm and stay warm with your hot water bottle rather than go down and warm up. And it's all these little things that contribute towards being a good warm up. And obviously I can't reveal, but sure. What we managed, we found a structure that we can tailor to specifically to each team. But I found a structure that predominantly prepares substitutes in a physical sense, and that aids the technical warm up as well. And what we found then is that substitutes become more consistent, and whether they're going to be consistently a 6 out of 10, then it's a case of working about how you can develop them into an 8 out of 10. But at least that consistency is coming first, rather than being an 8 and then being a 4 for the next 5 games, yeah. Then being an 8 and then being back to being a 4.
So without going into details, it is a routine. Can I say it's a routine that prepares players better?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's the word we use. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And what do you think then? Because now you see a lot of professional teams, they have, let's say, this physical rotation. So they make small groups or 3 or 4, and every 15 minutes, one of the groups goes out and does a warm up themselves. Mm. What is your opinion on that?
I think it's brilliant. I think it's almost one of the most basic things in football, I think, that you could address. But how many times do you see players go down, open the gate, maybe drop to one knee, maybe do a lunge, and then maybe walk back up, and that'll sure. be their 10th first half. And I always say that, like, the whole substitution thing is all you're trying to treat them like you would a starter, because you need them to have the same preparation that a starter has to go and influence a game of football. So if you were doing the warm-up at the beginning of the game and your starters were approaching their warm-up with that level of intensity, you would question where their head was at. You would question whether they were in it. You would question whether they were actually warm. But you don't see it, because starters are, you know, bang on it, make sure they do everything right, over accelerate, you know, make sure they're doing specific bits to the injuries they might have had. But when substitutes or players or finishers are left to their own devices, naturally, they get maybe a little bit complacent. And again, it doesn't always come through the fact that they're being malicious or with that fuck you attitude. It might be that they're just watching the game of football. And when they're doing that, they're not then prioritising their warm-up. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, I think it's great that they go down and warm-up. I think that's very much something that needs to happen more. But I would say the quality of it is sometimes often overlooked. And because a lot of the attention is on the 11 players who are starting for you and the 11 opposition and 100 other factors in football, it means that the staff don't always potentially check on what the substitutes are doing, because naturally goalkeeping coach is watching the goalkeeper, set piece coach is watching the set pieces, assistant and gaffer are watching the 11 in possession, out possession. You've got, you know, one up top on the mic who's looking at what they're doing, you know, so all this attention is going into making sure that we're going to try and win the game. And that's where that ownership needs to be placed on those substitutes to then sort of own their own warm-ups and own their preparation.
Yeah, well, I agree. You see, I think you do, you acknowledge it as well, you see a difference that nowadays, especially in professional football, they have these rotations. So you see these small groups going up and down the sideline. And then I think the clubs that really understood it put a coach there, probably a physical coach that does some warm-up routines there. So that's good, I think. But we all know, also seen in the, let's say, halftime, or before the match, only the substitutions playing to touch and laughing and flicking his ears, because they didn't do the touch right, which is a completely different process again. Which on the other hand, mentally, could also be positive. You have to leave them maybe to get them over a little bit disappointment and leave them alone a little bit. Depends a little bit on the player, like we discussed. I think there's a lot to gain, especially if you're talking about semi-pro or the levels there, because it's not common and the players are also different. They have a different attitude. So I think that's highly interesting. So that's one part in the process there. And how do you, so that's the physical involvement
and
discuss. But then there's also, let's say, a tactical involvement. So we've all looked behind us and said to a player, okay, really, really watch the striker because you could come on next in that role. And then you realize after 5 minutes he's not watching. Yeah, he's watching, but he's not thinking about it at all. So how would you deal with that? Or why is that so important to get players involved there?
Yeah, so so when I was at Wimbledon, because it was a full-time role, I was on the bench and I was in the dugout. So I would be having those conversations with the players. It wouldn't be a case of, like you said, as a gaffer, you turn around, you say, go and watch the striker or the centre-back that you're going to come on against or, you know, whatever. And then you turn around and focus back on the game. And again, the ownership is put on that player then to do that, which at times players don't sometimes do. So by me being on the bench, I'm fully involved. I fully know what the opposition analysis is. I fully know our game plan. I'm there on Friday, so I know the pressing shape. I know the areas that we're going to target. I know the spaces that we want to exploit. So when I'm on the dugout and I'm in the bench, I'm having this conversation with the players. And it's reinforcing what they've probably already know, because they're players, so they've played the game, that they're intelligent enough to understand the game. But it's that reinforcement, it's that focusing and channeling that energy that they've got into reading the game. And we actually last season had some really, really productive discussions on the bench about areas that they feel like that they could come on and add value. And again, it comes back to a massive sort of basic of coaching, where you don't want players who are going to follow instruction. You want players who are going to problem solve themselves. And what we found is that our substitutes were quite good at that, in that we would sit and we would discuss the game and they would give me the answers that I probably needed to hear. And then when they go on, it's a case of them then putting that into action and playing the pictures that they see.
Coaches, sorry for the interruption. Besides the coaches room, I run another company called Football Tours. This is a full-service touring company, and we organize pre-season and winter training camps for professional football teams. We do this for both senior and youth teams, and we take care of everything. Hotel, training accommodation, friendly matches, whatever you need. We give youth teams the opportunity to train at the best youth academies of the Netherlands. Academies like PSV, Feyenoord, AZ Alkmaar and the KNVB, you can train there with your team. So, if you are a professional coach, you need to organize your training camp, or if you have a youth team and you want to train at the best facilities in the best academies of the Netherlands, go to footballtours.com. And now pay attention, tours is with a Z. So footballtourswithaz.com.
So this is really guiding them players in the process. And now the counterpart of that is, okay, these are players. They should know that they should pay attention. Why do we have to help them in their responsibility, and why cannot they, can't they take them that responsibility themselves?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think in an ideal world, you would have every single player own every single part of training. But I always say the biggest thing, and I've worked at every single probably level of football up until League One, obviously. But how many times do you ask a player if they're going to attend training, and sometimes you don't even get players to put thumbs up for training? You know what I mean? And I'm talking a little bit of the lower levels now. But you go, oh, I need to know numbers for training. And the most basic of tasks, the simplest thing you could ask from a person is to put a yes or a no on a message where they're training. And you still then start training and three lads turn up who haven't said yes or no. And I think it's that level of ownership that if you can't get people to do that, you know what I mean? Like, I think we're a little bit far away from getting players to own every single part of the process. Yeah. I think that's something that the world is, or football is gearing towards, is having that ownership. I think there's a lot of managers now who talk about that ownership, and I think it's changing. I think that's becoming a thing now, because players are realizing that they have to do it, because it only benefits them as well. It's not like they're doing it for someone else. Them owning that process means that it's going to benefit them as a substitute, or in whatever capacity it might. But I think at the moment, I think a little bit far away, but I think it is going that way. Yeah. I think it is going.
Yeah, it is a balance. I agree, because at one point we say, no, the game is owned by the players. We coaches are only facilitators, and we have to leave it up to them. They have to make their own choices. They have to solve the problems. And in the other hand, it's also society, we tend to help them with everything. Mm. So we can all, I think what I'm hearing is that because you help them with this process and help them where that they should be involved and that they are actually involved, that you will not do it every game, every season. No, it is a learning process as well. If you do that, let's say the first five matches, at one point, match six, you should, I'm maybe over exaggerating, but match six, you should expect that they will do it more themselves, and they will be more ready themselves.
And what we did find actually is that, again, these guys, this is just relating to the substitution part of it, but these guys didn't do it because they didn't want to. They didn't do it because they didn't know they had to.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Putting the demand back on them and going, listen, I know you're a substitute, but I fully expect you to be engaged in this game of football. I fully expect you to be ready to come on at any given moment with your shirt and your shinnies, as well as to making sure you know the pressing shape. You know, these are things that again, it's not that players don't want to do it. I think it's that sometimes they just don't think about it, because particularly substitutions, it's just been set in stone. You know what I mean? It's the next part of the game to be modernized. But because it's not been modernized, you know, the routines, the structures, all these things that comes with substitutions have been done for decades now. So now it's trying to change that and put a little bit more demand on those things. And what we found at Wimbledon is that I you know, everyone at Wimbledon, I will credit to the player, that every single player approached it with the exact professionalism as if they were a starter. And we got to a stage where they knew what time they had to go out. You know, they knew the structure, they knew what warm-up they had to do, they would lead it themselves. It would just be a case of me almost just ticking boxes to make sure, you know, happy days, he's done what we asked of him.
Yeah.
And again, that proves my point, where they're not doing it because they don't want to, they just need that little bit of guidance, that little bit of follow first to go, okay, you know, that might be something that's going to help here, so let's commit to it.
Yeah, God, I completely understand that. I think it's evolving and then learning the players and also the coaches, that there's work to be done there, and how do you do it, and what are the details in which you can gain your performance or whatever. Okay, very clear. So that is, let's say, the process, and then if people want to hear details, call Sammy. But and then the next part is, okay, if you have the process right, so you're doing all these things, so you're preparing players better, they are more tactically involved, so they are probably, because this is my big question, then they should be more ready for the intensity of the game. Because I think a lot of people that watch a game say they see a player coming in, and a lot of times now they are, let's say, overwhelmed by the game itself, the intensity, the intensity of the duels, the pace of the game. But let's assume here that the process that we just explained will help them there.
Mm, yeah, 100%. Because if you, like, I always say, and the player what Mummy mentioned, but his name was Alefi Santos, and you know, he played at Derby, and he had a bit of career, and he found himself at Weymouth. And he was a player that really helped me sort of cultivate this concept, because he was someone who I really tuned into and really used as almost a case study to ask him about being a substitute, run a few things past him. And he was a substitute for Weymouth and or a finisher. And he came on into the game of football about 86 minutes. And he said, his exact words, it just passed me by. just because the intensity of a game of football, I think, is so high nowadays that if you sit still for 40 minutes and then just get up and go in, I think it does pass you by. I think that's a really nice way to phrase it. And that the ability to have an impact becomes less and less because you can't get a control, you can't get a handle on the game. And you've just touched on it there brilliantly, is that you need to like close that gap. At the moment, there's a massive gap between sitting and then going into a full sprint, you know, that might be in a press or it might be a running behind, going in, you know, your top speed in 8 seconds. But you can't just do that from sitting down. There has to be something that you bridge that gap with. And yeah, we got quite positive feedback from players, particularly from the physical perspective, as well as the data, actually, that suggested that we were closing that gap.
Yeah, that's exactly where I want to go, because what were your findings when you were digging into the data, let's say before, or teams that didn't do this process? And then what were the results when you start working with teams, and how did it change the data, or how did it change the outcome of substitutions?
We always talk about the word I use is productivity. You want productive subs. So you want productive subs technically, tactically, physically. And so relating it to the physical is that you need a sub who's going to be productive in a game of football. Now, that doesn't always look like running more, because it might be that you're 2-0 up, you're going to be a closer.
Sure.
So I'm fit into our shuffling shape and just go side to side, let them pass in front of us. And there might be the occasional sprint distance, top speed achieved from a counter or a chase ball or a recovery run. So you've got to be smart with the data, because you could have players that come on, run way more, you know, per minute than the average, but it might be that they've just run around like a headless chicken and they've not been deliberate with their running. So you have to interpret what you can from the data, and that comes with working with other departments. So working with the S&C guys and making sure that, you know, the understanding is there. But we saw more productive data from finishers coming on compared to their sort of previous data and the player that they were replacing.
Okay, so that's one point. So they were more productive. I agree. And then did you also see, could you share with me maybe some examples or percentages very superficial here, but prepared players have more. That's what I should say. You said want to have more impact in the game. Mm. Can you share some examples of that impact? Because impact is very superficial or subjective, but maybe some hard data on the impact that players had.
Yeah, cool. So again, these are what I would call surface level metrics. So it's data that I don't mind sharing, and it's probably all on my LinkedIn anyway. So more than happy. But little things like we made the most substitutes from losing positions while I was at Wimbledon. I just used Wimbledon's data, you know, rather than the other clubs. So we made the most subs when losing, and we actually had the third highest points gained from losing positions. So you talk about impact, that's something that they come hand in hand. And again, it's not complete alignment, because it's not like my three subs have gone on and won the game. It's a team effort, but they've added value. They've contributed towards that turn of a scoreline. We had the second most goal contributions from substitutes. So we had 12, which if you even look at today's sort of trends is still a fairly good return in per substitute value as well. And we also use a value that uses, effectively analyzes the scoreline that they contribute to while on the pitch. And we had the sort of sixth, seventh most performing, depending on the game state you look at, most productive substitute. So probably 30 or 40 other metrics that we would use now to analyze these tiny little margins of whether we think they're contributing enough. But on the surface, you know, that's the sort of production that we want from a substitute. And I always use, I think it was Shrewsbury, who the club who made 56% of their subs were attackers, and they didn't register a single goal contribution all season. And it's that where you're looking and going, that's just, that can't happen in today's game.
Yeah.
You know, where the game has two goals in. Do you know what I mean? You can't have not a single substitute contribute, you know, something that small and that's going to carry that much sort of weight. So they're sort of surface level. And again, I've done a little bit more on LinkedIn that anyone listening can have a look at, but they're the sort of things that we would look at to analyze whether we thought a substitute was productive.
Yeah, I think especially if you're coaching a team where winning is important, because if you're talking about youth, you also have, let's say, substitutes which create an equal playing field. For example, players need this amount of minutes, whatever. Let's take that out of the equation, because then there's a different expectation of the player or a different level, which is clear. But if you are coaching a team where winning is important, I think it's very easy to go through your own data. Okay, I've been 18 matches in. What have my substitutes done? What are the results? So I have, let's say, maybe 50% were attackers. It's a very simple analysis of your own games. You don't need to be a professional there. And just what was the impact, maybe on a superficial level, of those substitutions?
So for an example, is in Blackburn Rovers are in the Championship. That they're never a team I've worked with, but I've worked with a couple of teams in that league. So I've analysed the trends and the behaviours and the patterns of the data that we have of the Championship. And just while going through the data, I come across that they've made, off the top of my head, I think it was 11 substitutions while all in a drawing game state. So while the score was even, and every single time they went on to lose the game. So it's little things like that where you're looking at and you're going, there may be no correlation between, the starters, the finishers and the result. You know, you need to actually watch the game to have an understanding. You need to do the eye test.
Mildly said.
Yeah, you need, but that, you know, that is a pattern, you know, that can't happen in today's world where there's points and goal difference and goals that are so fine and everything's decided by such fine margins and 1%. I personally am of the belief that I would look at that and I'd be like, something needs to change, because that can't, if we're going to be at the top end of the division, that can't be sustainable for the rest of the year.
Yeah, no, if you're the coach of Blackburn, if they don't call you right now, they're making a joke. but it is, in these data, you can all get from your own games. So that's an interesting question. And it's not to criticize anybody. And I'm sure Blackburn are aware. And if they're not and they're listening, they are now. But this is exactly what you can do. And then your idea, okay, if all your substitutions have impact, you're probably doing something right. If it's not, then maybe you look at step one. Okay, what's the process? Or how do I prepare them? Which is part of our job as coaches. Okay, very, very interesting. So data proves or helps you in this process a lot. And you were talking about attackers. Are there any other metrics that you would say, okay, these are also highly interesting, or did you want to share something about?
Yeah, so the one thing that I've just started looking at the moment, actually, is obviously set pieces is a real trend at the moment. You know, people are getting set piece coaches and being more deliberate, and the set piece routines that are coming out, and, you know, goals get celebrated by set pieces now, because, you know, rightfully so, because they're so well worked and they're becoming a larger proportion of teams' total goals. So I thought, okay, well, let's like look into what the average set piece gets you in terms of a goal, in terms of a shot on target, in terms of XG and that sort of thing. And I only did it for the Premier League in this instance, but there are now 10 teams in the Premier League who have a greater chance of achieving a goal or a shot on target through a set piece than a substitute. And that, for me, I was looking at it and going, like, that's a brilliant angle for me, because I think that now I can use that and go, well, team set pieces have now sort of overtaken substitutes as a way of threat and a way of getting back into the game. But now it's almost like leaving substitutes behind.
Yeah.
And for me, that's, I don't know. I guess I just think in my head that if you're 1-0 down and you're sat as a gaffer, you're now going, I've got more chance, or half the Premier League teams have got, I've got more chance of getting back into the game via a set piece than I have via a substitute.
Yeah.
And I just, that's like a really damning statistic, you know. And of course, it's only for the Premier League. And it was off StatsBomb's data, who are quite, you know, a very reliable, you know, company. So it will differ for various leagues and other things like that. But I think this is what I mean when I say I think the next part of the game to be modernized is substitutes, because I don't think that that's an acceptable conclusion in football to just go, oh, if I need a goal or a shot on target, even to try and create a possibility of a goal, we're more likely having a corner than we are bringing on my attacker. I don't think that's a great place to be in football. I think, you know, especially when there's so many things you can do to enhance that probability.
Yeah, I think, well, the idea I now have is that you could even intertwine it so that you bring on a substitute that is strong with set pieces, so maybe the tall striker or whatever. So you know, okay, set pieces are at this point, and how can I use my substitute to strengthen that part of the game? Which is also bringing me to my idea on football, and which is what is going to look like in the future, is that it will be much more specialized, because now it went from 3 to 5 substitutes, which you have a lot more possibilities with your substitutes. The intensity of the game is becoming higher and higher. Recently in the women's game, I thought somebody tweeted that out of the top 10 female football players, 6 or something tore their ACL in the past 6 months.
Yeah,
just something about the intensity of the game. So a solution could be that there will be unlimited subs, or you can resub players, and then you really go into the area of specialized. Okay, we use the last 5 minutes of the first half or whatever to throw in the ball into the box, and I use my substitute because I want to get the tall striker and whatever. I'm just saying it out, thinking out loud here, but that could really change the impact of substitutes even more. Is there, in your opinion, something that changed going from 3 to 5? And do you ever think about maybe the evolution of the game, maybe towards even more specialized substitutions?
Yeah, I haven't thought in terms of future direction on where it might go. I tend to try and not live in the
now.
Yeah, try and play the picture now, because it means that I can be a little bit more deliberate with what's going on. But yeah, I absolutely think that moving to 5 over 3 is... So I did a graph again, it's on my LinkedIn. I did a graph where I looked at the substitute value, you know, per substitute, of the effect they have on the scoreline since moving from 3 subs to 5 subs. And I think, again, off the top of my head, I used 17 teams, because obviously 3 went up and went down, so their data is not reflective of the league they're in the year before. But 11 or 12, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it was 11 of those teams, their sort of substitute value has actually decreased. Because my argument is that rather than bringing on 3 unprepared players, you're now bringing on 5, which is now potentially half of your outfield lineup. So, you know, if you've the average pass completion of a substitute is now 60%, well, you now have 5 of those players on opposed to 3. So sometimes, in my opinion, the 3 can get carried by the 8, by the 7 starters, or 8 if you include the keeper. Whereas now when you're going, you know, 5 on, I think there's a drop off, so which is why I think you should be even more deliberate with it. Because I think if you can now make it count, I think there's a real gap in the market to make substitutes almost like a threat, and almost become like a part of your armory, where you go, oh, we're great at pressing, we're great at crosses, and we're great at substitutes. You know, there are now things that we can rely on to give us, you know, an advantage in a game of football. So, yeah, and obviously there's going to be examples where teams with bigger budgets are bringing on, you know, bigger players. And I don't think that's always the way, because I still think that bringing on a 9 out of 10 player who's unprepared doesn't mean he's going to perform as a 9 out of 10. So I still think there's arguments for teams with different budgets to still make the most of it. But yeah, I think moving to subs has had a drop off in the impacting overall score lines.
Yeah, which highlights again the importance of the process before bringing a player on.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it highlights the fact that they need to feel ready in all of the pillars. They need to feel confident. They need to feel like they're going to go on and actually impact the game of football, and they feel ready to do that.
Yeah, clear. Okay. Now I've been listening to you for almost an hour, and I think it's highly interesting. And also when Thomas told me about you, I think, okay, this is something we really should dive into. But I can imagine is that you somebody's asked somebody that's innovative at a club, which maybe sometimes is not the gaffer, and then comes in, oh, we should talk to you, and then you come in at the club. And then, yeah, hello, hi, I'm Sammy, I'm a substitution coach. And then the gaffer said, what the fuck? I've been doing substitutions for 30 years. What are you going to tell me about substitutions? So I think it's an interesting part there. And it also connected me maybe to the question that I ask everybody. So what are the hardest moments? So what and how do you deal with it? Because you are this expert, you are an innovative thinker. At least that's the way you come across and the way I perceive you, which also leads to resistance. Yeah, okay, what are you going to tell me? Oh, fuck off. I don't know how. I just bring him on. They shouldn't whine. They just perform, whatever. So were there any dark moments or, you know, the question that I'm going to ask you, what were the darkest moments, let's say, in this process, or maybe for you as a coach or whatever? And what have you learned from it?
So you're bang on in the a lot of people, because I am very deliberate with who I reach out to in terms of clubs and then what clubs reach out to me. There is a pattern that is forward-thinking clubs who are open to new ideas and do things, in my opinion, a little bit more in the right way. That sounds a little bit snobby of me, but things that I think I can trust that and trust the process and a little bit more of an identity. So largely when you're talking to those sorts of clubs, there isn't too much resistance because you're dealing with fantastic, open-minded, you know, not fixed-minded coaches. But, you know, right when I go back and I left Weymouth in the summer or of the summer of that year. Yeah. And I thought, I'd try and give this my all this subs idea and see if it can put me on the map as a coach. So I reached out to some clubs and I reached out to just people on LinkedIn. And I had some people on LinkedIn, had some phone calls that were probably two max and almost told me that I was, you know, chasing a dead end and that I was, I can't remember what one word, but just chasing dead ends effectively were that I should give up and that I should keep focusing on being a first team coach and pretty much fit into the norms of football society rather than try and develop something that I thought had value. Touching on it a bit, we touched on it earlier, but I'm not a player and I really want to work at the top. I want to test myself against the best. So in order to do that, I thought I've got to try and put myself on the map, which is where the whole subs idea came from, as something that can make me a bit unique and, you know, add to my skill set. So I thought, well, I can't just fit back into society because I think if I do that, you know, me getting to the top is going to take a whole lot longer. So I've definitely faced some resistance, and that's when I was, after three or four phone calls, that's when I said, right, I've got to start being deliberate with what clubs I go to, and which is why I went to Wimbledon, because I knew Robbo was very open-minded and very open to, if you've got something that you think can add value to us, then I'm all ears. And they had a set-piece coach, they had a mindset coach, they had a head of performance, they had lots of other things that suggested they were quite open-minded. But probably the worst moment was when I actually got let go at Wimbledon. There was a managerial change and a few of the staff were changed and the new manager came in and didn't give me the chance. Do you know what I mean? And I don't hold anything against them. People have their own opinions and I completely respect that. Do you know what I mean? So he came in and he was probably going to be there for a short term. He knew that. So he didn't need to build this big legacy and identity of a club, which is sometimes where my role comes in. So he was just thinking, how can I get results short and fast, and wasn't too interested in specialist coaches. So I was let go, and it was probably quite a tough moment for me because it wasn't the reality of the situation being negative, because I've faced quite a lot of adversity in my life. So comparing this to that is nothing, you know what I mean? I was almost woke up the next day and was like, well, it's a bit shit, but you know, it's the hand you've been dealt. So control the controllables and try and react now in a positive way. The big thing that was negative for me was it was the reality of that's maybe what the football industry is like a little bit. And it was a little bit harsh. And I was only 24, 25. So I was still learning my way a little bit. And it was real savage, you know, the way that it sort of it came about. And
again, I don't know. There's the door.
Yeah. And I don't hold any grudges. I mean, I still have some really good friends at Wimbledon and some of the players I'm still in contact with and stuff. So, you know, I wish them all the best as a club. But yeah, it was just, I think the reality that happened and ironically, the guy I'm going to nominate for this next podcast, Steve Salas, we had some great chats and he pretty much said to me, like, this unfortunately is the way football goes sometimes. So you've got to find a way to survive in it. And it was great advice because that was when I sort of reflected on myself and was like, right, well, if that's what it's going to be like, you're just going to have to suck it up and you're just going to have to learn not only a way to survive with it, but then learn to thrive with it.
Yeah.
And I went into a club not long after the whole Wimbledon thing sort of shut down. And I talked through my situation and he was saying what happened and I explained. And he said, you're never really in football until you get sacked. And it was like that was probably like the last moment where I was like, right, like, I feel like I'm in football now. Do you know what I mean? I feel like I've accomplished something almost. But yeah, that was probably the hardest moment in terms of the resistance phase, because I wasn't even given a chance to present and say, listen, this is the value I'm adding. This is why I think it's good. This is why I think you should keep it. But it's the nature of the industry. Do you know what I mean? You have to prioritize things, and he chose to prioritize other things. And I think, you know, he'll know if he made the right decision.
Yeah. Well, the football world is also, if he won the next 10 games, he was right, which is completely superficial, but that's the way people look at football also. Which I'm not saying I'm agreeing, but yeah, it is the case. And then you're fastly forgotten. But yeah, I think in your case, they're going to treat you like an idiot until they think you are a genius. So there's like this point of no return. All of a sudden, oh, we should have that. And then until it's like, if people don't really know, they're a little bit anxious to do it probably. And we've all know these dinosaurs in football, which is also a term that Raymond Verheyen uses, the old ones. We've always done it like that. So why should we change? And yeah. I also think that, and I do think that you need those types of coaches at certain moments. If you're battling relegation and you're firing the coach 10 games before the end of the season, you don't need a process coach. You just need somebody that bangs the door, gets the players ready within 2-3 days, and just have them fight on the pitch. And there's maybe no time. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but sometimes in those situations, you can also, okay, I'm going to throw out all innovation. I'm just going to keep it simple. But in the long run, you need different approaches. I also agree with that.
Yeah. And like I said, I don't hold any grudges about the way that it happened now. I reflect, because it is the nature of the industry. And, you know, he prioritized what he thought. And sometimes I always relate it to a car. Do you know what I mean? Like, my concept might have been that we had a really nice steering wheel, but if the wheels had fallen off, he didn't need a really nice steering wheel. He needed to come and fix it back on. So, you know, the steering wheel is the last of his thoughts. He needs to make sure that the engine, the wheels and the gearbox are running first before he starts adding, you know, the nice mirrors and the nice doors and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it's the way that it's where it's gone. And it was at Wimbledon actually that they said, just because it's been done the longest, it doesn't mean it's always been done the best. And that was probably what I relate to the most, is that, you know, just because subs have been done this way the whole time, it doesn't mean that they're actually the right way that they could have been done. You know, there are probably other things you could do with them.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, interesting. I think also in our podcast with Ariel Jacobs, which has been launched a couple of weeks before we launched this one. He's also said, okay, if you're winning, you get the rewards, but you still have to be humble. And if you are sacked, or if things go wrong, you are the one that or the coaches are the ones that get to blame. The ones that get the pain, so it's just part of of being a coach. Okay. You kind of already mentioned the name there, which is the last question of our podcast.
Yeah.
And that is, who should we talk to next?
So I'm going to nominate Steve Salas. He's an incredible guy. He's been on the High Performance podcast. So he's really sort of switched on. He's a mindset coach, so his background's fascinating. He's got a book out, and I think he's bringing another book out soon. But he really works with sort of the mindset of players and challenging, again, challenging norms and challenging, you know, I work quite closely with him, particularly with the subs, because the mindset and approach that you have, perspective on subs, links in a lot with what he touches on. And he, yeah, he's brought out some books and everything he champions is something I really believe in. And both on a professional and a personal note, he's always been sort of there to support me. So, yeah, I'm really, really grateful. And I think he'd be a really good sort of guest for this, because he, some of his messages are just so clear. He just simplifies things in the most basic form, but that carries sort of the most complex meaning. It's probably the way that I can phrase it. So for example, he always says, "We, not me." That's his biggest thing. And so that, again, we talk about your sub who went on, scored the winner, was brilliant. Was he being "we, not me," or was he being "me, not we"? Do you know what I mean? So it's little things like that. And it's such an easy phrase, and it will stay with me forever. And I use it as part of my concept now. But when all you have to do is say that phrase, and it can lead to so many extra thoughts and so many more layers. And yeah, he's really good like that. So I think he'd be a great guest for this podcast.
Cool. Well, really looking forward to it. And hopefully you can help us getting in touch. And for now, I really want to thank you for sharing your expertise. Let's pitch you really hard to the rest of the world. If they want to know more details, they can find you on LinkedIn. I think that's the easiest way.
Yes, so I'm not on social media really. I got rid of, well, I never had Twitter, and I don't really use my Instagram too much. So yeah, LinkedIn is probably the best platform where I try and publish my little bits of my work and reach out to people via clubs and that sort of thing. So yeah.
So I highly suggest that you start following Sammy on LinkedIn to see if he can provide you some knowledge. And if you think you are a coach or a club that fits in his innovative category, so if you don't think you're a dinosaur, then make sure that you connect. Because what you do is, let's say, club oriented or let's say first team, second team, or youth team oriented as well. What kind of clubs or teams would you like to work with?
Yeah, any. I'm open. I've got no preference in terms of like countries. I've done a bit of work with people from various different countries now, and it works just as well as when you're in the UK. All I would say is that, you know, I'm open-minded to any club. You know what I mean? I'm just as open-minded as well in terms of, you know, opening your eyes to maybe the ways that I can add value. But yeah, clubs who just want to, clubs who want to learn, really. Clubs who want to add value, clubs who want to improve.
Okay. I think it's a highly underestimated part of football, which is not in the focus of the first team coach. He has to manage already so much that this is something that you probably take for granted, which is not good or bad. It's just prioritizing. So, but with some small details, I think, or easy details, I don't think it's small. You can improve your process and get more. I think the main thing you said is you get more impact of your substitutes. And that's what we all want. If you bring in a substitute. Okay. There are also substitutes that go for that replace an injured player, but they also need to have at least the same impact as the player that you're taking off. And then you have your tactical or your decision that you want to impact the game. And I think you've gave us a great insight on how to, not how to, because they have to call you for that, but gave us some insight on how you can improve this. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate sort of the invite and being given this platform to sort of not only chat football, but a little bit about subs. And yeah, I'm really grateful for the invite. I've really enjoyed it.
Cool. Okay. I really want to do this again in maybe 1 or 2 years to see where you're at that point and see what kind of impact your work had on the game. So that could be really interesting.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, Sammy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, bye, everybody. Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside the Coach's Room. Make sure to subscribe or rate us in your favorite podcast player, or share this episode on your social media, and we will make sure that you will get access to the best webinar that's available on our website. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I would be happy to connect.